Welcome to the NPR Movie Podcast, our weekly roundup of NPR love for the movies. On deck this week, we hear why those annoying, cute little chihuahuas are popular as film characters. NPR's Bob Mondello weighs in on Nick and Nora. An African-American filmmaker talks about chasing the American dream in South Africa. And actress Julianne Moore talks about her latest film. But first, a return to an indie spirit for a big-name Hollywood director.
For Oscar-winning director Jonathan Demme, Rachel Getting Married is a gratifying return to his independent film roots. And for actress Anne Hathaway, of all people, it's a career-changing performance. Hathaway is best known for movies like The Princess Diaries. Here she plays Kim, an ultra-troubled young woman released from rehab for her sister's wedding. Even though Kim has trouble recognizing where her own needs end and other people's boundaries begin, she gets to make a toast at the rehearsal dinner.
Hello. I am Shiva the Destroyer and your harbinger of doom for this evening. I would like to thank you all for coming and welcome you, even though I haven't seen most of you since my latest stretch in the big house. But you all look fabulous.
Everyone's been to weddings like this, where unresolved issues ignite in front of your eyes. Rachel Getting Married also dares to mix the bitter with the sweet. It understands that life-altering situations like weddings not only bring out the worst in human behavior, but also the finest. All kinds of tunes, most memorably the a cappella version of Neil Young's Unknown Legend, run through this film like a river, suffusing it with joy at the moments it needs it most.
Somewhere on a desert highway, she rides a Harley Davidson.
If Kim's toast jolts us with its surprising bitterness, that song, sung by the groom as part of the wedding ceremony, lifts us up with its unexpected affirmation.
The chrome and steel she rides, colliding with the very air she breathes. The air she breathes.
Because it is willing to take chances like this, Rachel Getting Married could have gone off the rails any number of ways. It didn't because director Demme's firm but unobtrusive hand gives us the kind of emotionally honest moments that big studio money can't buy.
The oversized sunglasses, the oversized handbags, starlets and socialites' accessories just keep getting bigger. Except one. Those dogs they carry in their purses just get smaller. Now, there's a movie called Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
My name is Poppy. I put the wow in Chihuahua.
NPR's Allison Bryce explores the Chihuahua's larger-than-life appeal.
In the movie, Chihuahuas wear hats, 90s, and big sparkly jewels. They sit on doggy-sized pool chairs. The boys sweet-talk the girls.
Mi corazón!
Oh.
You are lovely!
Who is that hunk of Chihuahua?
If you ever need someone to lick inside your ears, I would be most honored.
Woof.
Chihuahua lover Alan Resnick says a movie with talking Chihuahuas is funny because they think they are capable of anything.
They really don't know their own size. So if you don't coddle them and you treat them like a dog, they really are ready to take on the world.
Alan Resnick spent the summer as a judge on the reality show America's Greatest Dog. He's incensed that disrespecting chihuahuas is rampant throughout pop culture. It all started with that chihuahua in the Taco Bell commercial in 1997.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
And in 2001, Legally Blonde shows Reese Witherspoon dressing her chihuahua sidekick in every shade of pink.
Welcome to Harvard.
Neither one of them get respect walking the halls of Harvard Law School.
Don't be scared. Everyone will love you.
Pick up any celebrity magazine, and likely you'll see a chihuahua tucked under the arm of Paris Hilton or Britney Spears. It looks like they're trying to match their headband to their dog to their shoes.
You know, they're not an accessory. They're a dog.
Melissa Kagan is at a chihuahua meetup group at a park. When a 5-pound chihuahua named Santino approaches, Kagan doesn't see that it's shaking uncontrollably. She sees its goggles, dog goggles. They call them doggles.
The goggles! You have to tell me where you got those goggles. I need to get a pair. Sorry. I was just asking around everybody, where did you get your goggles?
Santino's owner is Sue Park.
He is wearing a navy-colored polo shirt from Ralph Lauren, and it has like the polo embroidery on his back, and he's wearing a goggles, which is to protect his eyes. Goggles, yeah.
Dressing a dog like a Barbie doll worries Alan Resnick, editor-at-large of Dog World magazine. He's afraid people will see Beverly Hills Chihuahua and want to buy one. After the 101 Dalmatians movie, everybody wanted a Dalmatian. But as soon as the novelty wore off, the dogs ended up at shelters, or the pound.
You know, you can toss a handbag back in your closet when it's no longer in fashion, but dogs shouldn't be relegated to, you know, the status of a clothing item, and dogs just aren't disposable.
So if Chihuahuas aren't your thing, next month the movie Bolt comes out. It stars a German Shepherd. Allison Bryce, NPR News.
Now, a duo by the names of Nick and Nora. We're not talking about Nick and Nora Charles of Thin Man fame. There is a new incarnation in the movie Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which opens today. This Nick and Nora are teenagers, and they spend all night searching for a secret concert, and they fall in love along the way. Bob Mondello says the material is familiar, but the movie is smarter than usual.
Nick's a sweet, dweeby high school kid with girlfriend problems. Basically a Michael Cera sort of guy, so it's nice that Michael Cera actually plays him. His girlfriend, Triss, walks all over him. And as you can hear from the phone messages he leaves her, he's having trouble dealing.
You know, I think last time we spoke, we both kind of said some really nasty things that neither of us meant, you know, just like... He broke up with me, you know, everything, on my B-day.
Left to his own devices, Nick would just sit at home and mope, but he plays in a band, and tonight there's a secret indie concert he and the band are hoping to find somewhere in New York. A lot of other kids are trying to find it, too, including Nora, played by Kat Dennings as a smart, sarcastic Catholic schoolgirl who does not want to appear dateless when she's spotted by what she would call a frenemy.
Nora! Alone again?
I came here with someone, actually.
Who?
My boyfriend.
Your boyfriend? Well, I guess you should be getting back to him then.
Yeah.
Scanning the crowd, Nora spots the least threatening guy, Nick.
Could you be my boyfriend for 5 minutes?
What?
Just go with it.
Which would be great, except the frenemy who recognized her is Triss.
Nick! Nora! How do you guys, like, know each other?
What?
Are you Triss's Nick?
How do you know her?
Oh, dear God.
Having thus met Cute, Nick and Nora will spend the rest of the movie sparring Cute, trading quips and insults, and at one point a punch that leaves Nick temporarily speechless. Happily, things do mellow along the way, which you can tell despite the sparring, because Nick lets Nora check out both his car and his iPod.
This is amazing. You are literally like my musical soulmate.
Maybe I'll take this for a bit and you can just focus on driving.
Why, you don't like my... sweet grooves.
It's just I need something to distract myself from the fact that you're driving my car pretty recklessly right now.
I'm a great driver. Fine.
Though these two really grow on you, what's almost more remarkable than Nick, Nora, or their playlist, which may not be infinite, but which really does include some great music, is the quirky melting pot world that director Peter Sollett creates around them. Vibrant like New York, youthful like the stars, awkward like the characters they're playing, it's unselfconsciously diverse. Nick is the only straight member of his rock band, for instance, a queercore group that in most movies would fade into the background, but that here becomes more and more central. Nora is a Jewish girl in Catholic school, a fact that goes as unremarked as the suburban-urban and sophisticate doofus character divides. Sex and alcohol figure in the film, but in ways that are gratifyingly unexpected. And gum? Lordy, what happens with gum in this picture you will never, ever forget. Nor, I suspect, will you forget Nick and Nora, who cruise around a New York that seems as romantically supercharged as in any Woody Allen movie, listening to that infinite playlist and falling for each other as audiences will fall for them. I'm Bob Mondello.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. For some people, the American dream is not found on U.S. soil. Instead, they seek it in South Africa. A new documentary, Blacks Without Borders, follows a group of African-American entrepreneurs who have made South Africa their land of opportunity. Stafford Bailey, the director of the documentary, joins me now. How you doing?
I'm fine. How about yourself?
Oh, doing great. We've just had a good conversation about our Baltimore roots.
Yeah.
So I always got to recognize. But you have had another long journey going to South Africa to shoot this documentary. How did you even come up with the idea?
Well, when I've done a few things in Africa, and I kept finding people, African-Americans living in Africa, and I kept thinking, that's a odd place to live. And then one of the jobs that I do a lot of making of behind the scenes of movies, and I travel a lot, and I keep seeing a lot of African-Americans in foreign countries. And then I talk to somebody here, and they say, oh, yeah, I have a good friend that lives in South Africa. And I said, really? And then someone else knew someone. I said, there's something here. Then I searched the internet, and I saw an article written in, it was from an Atlanta paper, and it talked about all these African Americans living in South Africa. I think it was more. It was the second high. I think Nigeria has the most, and then South Africa was growing. And I only thought about apartheid, but you know, I kept thinking, you know, when I saw the images of apartheid, so I started investigating it more, and I started seeing, no, it's not like it. There's a story here, so I went down to check it out.
Give me, you know what? Actually, I'm gonna go ahead and play a little bit of your film, so to give us a sense of what people see there. Here's a little bit from a woman who started a business in South Africa.
I feel more comfortable in South Africa than I ever have in the U.S. You are a person here. You know, you don't have to apologize for being black like you do in America.
Tell us who we were hearing there.
That was Cora Vaughn. She was an attorney in Chicago making over $1 million a year, and then she sold it all and moved to South Africa to run a bed and breakfast. And she lives in an area in Johannesburg. It's one of the most exclusive areas up there. As a matter of fact, she lives up the street from Nelson Mandela. And she just, like, she sees, she you in the documentary, you hear more of her story, but she really never felt, even though she was very successful here in the U.S., she never felt like she really belonged. And she really never felt real comfortable. And then she just decided, after traveling every year to different parts of Africa, she wanted to see was there a place in Africa where she could actually live. And then she went into moved to Johannesburg, and she loved it. She's doing great. She never looked back. She said, like she says, she has no regrets.
You also talked to two gentlemen who worked in the telecom industry, started a very successful company. Tell us a little bit about their story.
Yeah, Robert and Eric. Yeah, these two guys, they had big, really big ideas, and they decided to come together in South Africa because the opportunity to do what they wanted to do didn't present itself in the United States. And their goal was to become the largest satellite cable provider on the continent. And their thing is, if we would have gone into any American bank and tried to say we want to be the biggest in anything, they would have laughed them out the building. And they didn't get that in Africa. Because see, the thing is, in Africa, the glass ceiling doesn't exist in Africa. You can go as far as your ability goes, and it will take you. And that's what's so exciting about them. So they didn't have that they're handicapped with them. So they had the ideas, they had the vision, and they can go as far as they want to go. And I think they have 40% of the market right now.
But don't you think there's just a different cut on the glass ceiling? Because, for example, you know, there one thing I have heard, you know, going to South Africa every now and then, is that there's a glass ceiling that affects black South Africans more profoundly than it affects black Americans, because black Americans come in, we've got a sort of outsider cachet, and that frankly during apartheid there was a whole generation of people that weren't educated well who were black South Africans. So we come in, you know, having had a civil rights movement earlier, having been able to go to college and get degrees of higher education earlier. And so maybe there is a glass ceiling that affects black South Africans more profoundly. Did you get any sense that there was resentment from some black South Africans?
No, there wasn't any resentment. As a matter of fact, because of what we went through in the civil rights, we're kind of like their role model. They figure we've gone through it. And, you know, a lot of them think everybody in America is rich anyway. But we've gone through their version of the apartheid, and we accomplished things, and that's what they aspire to be. So when African Americans come there, I don't see the resentment. But what did happen in the beginning, there, when apartheid first was dissolved, there was a lot of African Americans who came down who promised a whole lot of stuff and they couldn't deliver. So that put a bad taste in a lot of South Africans' mouth. But the new group that went after that group, they all those are gone. A new group came in. That's not a problem with them. It's not more, it's more because, unfortunately, a lot of during the apartheid are in their 40s now, and they didn't get the education that, you know, that we did over here. So they're behind. It's like playing catch up. What a lot of Americans are doing is helping them to, you know, get to that point.
Do you see, and just quickly before, you know, we have to let you go, do you see a continued opportunity now during this financial crisis?
It's a perfect place to go right now for the because of the crisis that we have in the U.S. Because in South Africa, it has the fastest growing middle class in the world.
Stafford Bailey is the director of Blacks Without Borders. He joined us here at our NPR West studios.
She's played a porn star and a daring 50s housewife. She hunted Hannibal Lecter and was hunted by dinosaurs. Now, actress Julianne Moore plays a seeing woman in a sightless world in the new movie Blindness, directed by Fernando Morales. In the movie, a city is struck with an epidemic of blindness called white sickness. The victims are rounded up and thrown under quarantine in an abandoned insane asylum. Julianne Moore's character pretends to be blind when her husband loses his sight so she can go with him.
You can't be responsible for everyone. You need to get some sleep. Are you afraid to close your eyes?
No. Afraid to open them. Afraid I'll go blind in my sleep. I'm gonna take a walk.
Blindness is based on the novel by José Saramago, and as Julianne Moore told me, the characters enter a world of complete isolation.
Everyone's belief is they're being taken to a hospital where they're going to be cared for, and when they arrive, they're basically in an institution with limited food and no clean water and no, you know, no one to care for them and no linens, and it's basically sort of like a lockdown, which is a big, I think, a surprise to each and every one of the characters. And as the movie proceeds, it becomes clear to them that no one is coming, that no one is going to help them, and that the guards are just there to keep them in.
It was interesting to me that in this, you know, filthy and crowded and ultimately very violent and depraved space, the moment when your character breaks down and cries, mm-hmm, is when her husband asks her, "What time is it?"
Yeah.
And you say,
"I forgot to wind my watch," and she starts to cry. And it's in the book, too. That moment is in the book, and it's such a moving moment in the book, and I don't even feel like I do it justice. It's so amazing because that's the stuff that we grieve over. You know, it's really about a lack of control. You know, one thing that she does know in this place is the time. That to me is real tragedy. It's, you know, those are the things that kind of move us. And, you know, it's not, oh, Superman's going to pick up the subway train. You know, it's not about that to me. It's about the little things, whether or not somebody manages to keep themselves together in a tragedy that way, or wind their watch or whatever, you know.
The tiny moments.
Mm-hmm.
When you're filming, how aware are you of what the ultimate look and sound even of the movie will be? I mean, in this case, it's very washed out, very, mm-hmm, milky. Are you thinking about that as you're shooting?
Well, it's interesting because there are some things that you definitely have to think about. That blown out sort of milky quality, we were not aware of at all. I actually saw that when Fernando showed Mark and I some footage that had been cut together.
Mark Ruffalo,
yeah. And we were both like, whoa, we didn't know about the white stuff. But what's important for me to know about is how the camera is telling a story. And Fernando is eloquent with his camera. His shots are very, very emotional, the way they're framed. You know, there's intention kind of in every shot. And for me, it's really helpful to see that. But the other stuff, you know, the sound and the way a film is timed, for example, the way the colors are, that you don't see until much, much later.
Are those conversations you have with the director as you're going through, or are you really getting most of what you need from the screenplay itself?
I get it from the screenplay, and then I watch what they do with the camera. I need to know what I'm doing, and I need to know what the perspective is. I need to know what the proscenium is so that I can be within that, you know, the story is told within that frame. So I want to know what that frame is. So those conversations I will have with the director, or I'll really, really pay attention to angles and sometimes ask to see a storyboard or shot list or that kind of stuff. But the other stuff, you know, what happens afterwards with the editing and the mixing and the sound, that's all, that's, you know, it's a director's medium. So that's all their prerogative. That's all their business.
Do you ever have directors who say, don't worry about that. You know, that's my part of this. You just act. Do they ever you're intruding too much?
No, not any good directors. Bad directors do.
You've
bad
had
directors
that happen?
Oh, yes.
Well, what do you do then?
You panic. You know, it hasn't happened to me very often, but it has happened.
Gosh, I sure want to know who you're talking
about
right
now. Yeah, I can't say. but you know, but then there are, but great directors tell you. You know, you're not just working with a director. It's not just a director and an actor. You're also, there's not camera, there's a DP there. There's a camera operator. There's the dolly grip. There's the focus puller. There's, you know, there's the boom operator. There are a million people working on that shot. And we all need to know what the shot is so that we can do our job.
And why is that helpful to you as an actor to know where that frame is?
It's a visual medium, you know. So I was working with an actor, a really great actor, who does a lot of theater work. And he was doing something, and I said, you know, I said something, I said, you know, I said, you know, the lens is over there, something's happening. And he said, what do you mean? I said, they can't see you. And and he was like, really? He goes, well, I thought that if I'm just acting, the camera's going to pick it up. I said, no, it's a, you know, it's a proscenium device. I mean, you have to figure out what, if you're, you know, we're not, I think there's this misnomer about acting sometimes that we're just out there and we're like feeling stuff and the camera's going to pick up what we're feeling. You know, it's deliberate, and sometimes it's very physical, sometimes it's emotional and it happens on screen, whatever. But you have to have an awareness of where the story is being told.
You're still getting lots of what seemed to me to be very meaty parts at 47. As you look forward, are there kinds of roles that interest you? Are there places that you want to go maybe that age will afford you that maybe you couldn't do before?
Yeah, age affords you everything in that way. I mean, life affords you everything because you, every stage in your career, there's a time to play a certain kind of role. I don't really think about what I want to do. I think because I have so little control over it. in a way, I sort of keep my focus a little bit short. So I really only know what I want to do by reading it. Like, I'll read something and I'll think, like, wow, that's really compelling. Wow, I want to do that.
Do you ever hear, and I hate to even think about this, but do you hear from, I don't know, an agent or a director, you know, you'd be great, but we need somebody younger?
No. Mm-mm. I haven't heard that, but I'm not playing the girl in the action movie either. You know, I think that's where you would encounter that. But, you know, also remember that the girls in the action movie are playing the girls in the action movie because that's where they are in their career. You know, I mean, there was a time when I did play the girlfriend or the whatever, or the where I am. I can feel when I read something and I feel like I'm too young for it too, or I'm too old for it. I actually think it ends up being more of a personal decision for me more than anything else.
Well, Julianne Moore, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Julianne Moore's new movie is called Blindness.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.